Hello. Welcome back to Philippine X and Wellness. For episode 7 of season 4, I will be co-hosting with Marking, and we are excited to bring to you all cultural perspectives on wellness with author and co-founder of the Kailukuan School of Indigenous Science, Ka Virgil Mayor Apostol. Join us as we talk about different traditional ancestral healing and wellness practices in the Philippines. We hope that you enjoy this episode. Maayong adlaw, welcome to episode 7 of season 4 for the Philippine X and Wellness podcast. I am your host, Cheryl Sampson Ramirez, and my pronouns are she, her, sha. For this episode's audio description, currently I'm wearing a yellow t-shirt mimicking the weather outside. It's really hot right now where we're at in the Los Angeles area. And currently, I have silver headphones that go over my ear, gray dangling shell earrings, and in my background, I have a black curtain. For this episode, I'd like to introduce my co-host, Marking.
Hello, everyone. My name is Marking. I am co-hosting, and my audio description is I am bald. I have a goatee with a pointed beard chin. I'm wearing earbuds, wearing a blackish gray shirt with specks on it. And in my background, I have a sign that says never, never give up, which is kind of reflected with light, so you can't really see it. I also have a white background and a mirror in the back as well. Following our last episode, Mental Health and Chronic Pain with Dr. Rona, who has a doctorate in psychology, this month we will be bringing back a guest from our first season on Clubhouse. This time around, we'll be talking about cultural perspectives on wellness and with author and co-founder of Kailukuan School of Indigenous Science, Ka Virgil Mayor Apostol.
Bagabigatyo amin apo. Yes, my name is Virgil Mayor Apostol, and I am actually wearing a almost like a forest green long sleeve shirt. I'm wearing a Lingling old jewelry pendant and also a crocodile tooth. In my background, there are various swords or bunangs, bolos, along with some pictures and the Philippine flag.
Thank you. Welcome, Ka Virgil. As mentioned in previous episodes, all views discussed are for informational and educational purposes only. It's not meant to be medical advice, nor does it constitute therapy or professional advice. Always consult with your healthcare practitioner, especially before starting any exercise or new health program, or a qualified mental health professional for your particular condition. Without further ado, we'd like to welcome to our podcast, Ka Virgil. Marking, take it away with our first question.
Sure. We typically like to open our episodes with knowing where our guests are from. To your knowledge, where are both sides of your family from, and where are you currently streaming from as well?
Okay. Currently streaming, I'm in Walnut, California, which is in East LA County. Now, on my paternal side, my father, Vidal Santos Apostol Sr., he was from Kamiling Tarlac, which is the northern half of Tarlac bordering Pangasinan. On my mother's side, Anselma Miguel Mayor Apostol, she is from Lawag, Ilocos Norte.
Awesome. Nice. So the original title for this episode was going to be Cultural, Societal, and Holistic Perspectives on Health and Wellness. That in itself could almost be three different episodes, and we'll probably, hopefully, maybe revisit that at a later point. But for this particular episode, we are looking for the cultural perspectives on wellness. Now, many of us throughout the diaspora may be far removed or unaware of each of these perspectives on health and wellness due to factors such as colonization, acculturation, and assimilation, just to name a few, that stem either from migration or even survival. If you could provide for us an overview of the cultural perspectives on wellness through your own research and regional roots to really contextualize it with our diverse archipelago.
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay, so no matter what the title is, because I'm a lateral thinker, I make the connection. So even if the title is just one word, I will make a reference to all different aspects so that we have an overview of all the different perspectives that make whatever it is what it is. If we go to the root of our way of thinking, our psychology, our society, our culture, we really come from an animistic base. And if we look at animism, that is the foundation for shamanic practices. So with this animistic base, basically, if you look at the term ani, or let's say, one thing that I like to offer as an exercise, if we go ahead and look at each other, so if we look at each other right now, what are we looking at? Are we looking at the ears or the goatee? What are we looking at?
I'm looking at your eyes.
Eyes, okay. And the eyes are considered?
To the soul.
Yeah, there you go.
Yes, the portals, the windows, as they say traditionally. And so if these are the windows to the soul, then this right here would be considered the windows.
The framing of the soul?
The framing, the house.
The house.
Soul. Yes. There okay, you go. So in the head is housed the brain, the wutak. Okay. Now, if we look back at a time when headhunting was prevalent around the world, actually, they were just taking the head of the enemy or the victim, but they were capturing the soul of the individual. Mm-hmm. And of course, depending on what their motives were, in the Philippines, for example, in the highlands, they would take the head of the individual, but yet the soul of the individual was also welcomed into the community, because now they brought them in. It's the soul, so they made sure that the soul became part of the community. So they may have helped them with protection, with agriculture, maybe with human rights and such. It was for that reason why some of the warriors, they would even partake in consuming some of the brain, because they believed that they were taking in the soul essence, the power of the individual when they consumed some of the brain. Sometimes they would mix it with rice wine or another type of liquor. Now, headhunting was done everywhere, not only in the highlands, but also in the lowlands as well, as documented by the Spanish, even amongst the Tagalog regions and the Ilocos regions. It was a practice that was done, similar to seeing how the wheel was invented. It would have eventually been invented everywhere throughout the world. So with this belief system, with the capturing of the ani to. Ani and to. These are two different terms. Ani is an Austronesian nation term meaning residence of, and then to is spirit, so spirit resident or resident of the head. We can also see it in some of the other terms. But because we find in other languages, this means that this is a very archaic word that spread throughout the globe. Ani, animus, animas, the male principle or female principle, spirit principle, as they know in Greek. Something that is animated, is full of life. Mm. So we, and also other languages, they do have the term ani in there as well, or even to in various cognate forms. So the base foundation for our way of thinking, acting, performance, believing is really basing from spiritual foundation.
Just quick question. So the actual practice of headhunting was actually, it was to honor the victim because you're taking in part of their spirit. Is it my understanding that correctly, or?
It's kind of twofold.
It's twofold.
Of course, there were some wars and disputes, and so they would constantly go back and forth, taking hits. Mm-hmm. But then there was still that form of reverence because of the understanding that they are, or they were, capturing the soul of the individual.
Sure. Got it. Interesting.
Even in the Lopes regions, it was told by my Lola, my uncles, that, well, there were two different practices. So one was to obtain a head, and they would place it into the foundation of a bridge. And this was believed to appease the deity of the waters so that they wouldn't wash the bridge away. The other practice was when an apu or somebody who had a high status, when they would pass away. Sometimes what we know now is rigor mortis, they would observe the fingers. If, for example, the body got stiffened and two fingers all of a sudden extended, it was the old belief that this meant that the soul of the individual was requesting for two companions. So they would literally go and take someone's or people's lives. It was either that or even just to take their pinky. So there was a lot of practices that were done. The thing about it is that back then, this was the norm. These days we'll say, oh, that's so backwards, mm-hmm. But that was the norm. And it's very important that we have to look at these practices from the eyes of the people during that era.
Right.
It is a way of looking at things from an emic point of view, looking at it from the inside as opposed to an edic, I hope I'm getting this correct, edic, which is looking from the outside inward.
Right. You get more context of the actual practices.
Mm-hmm.
I have a follow-up to that, Virgil. Virgil. So taking a person's soul during the headhunting practice was one practice and tradition during that time. Through your research, during the time where many of our people were practicing animism, the majority pre-colonial, let's say, what were the other health and wellness practices that existed to your knowledge during that time?
On that time? Oh, a reverence to the elements. The elements and elementals. Now, we all know about if you pass by like a wooded area and we see some kind of odd-looking structure or an ant mound or something like that, we would say baribari apo or tabitabi po.
Mm-hmm.
These were like a foretelling or forewarning to the entity within the spirit entity that you're going to pass. And that's a way to ensure that they wouldn't get pissed off and do something.
Right.
There are so many stories, so many different stories. For example, there was one where this took place in one of the towns in the Lobos Norte, where they built a house, but yet in the backyard, there was already in existence an ant mound. And so the owner of the house decided to go out one day and, take a wee-wee. But he pissed on the ant mound there by pissing off the entity. Now, what happened was that he became ill, basically, afterwards. And he went to the male doctors, and they couldn't, you know, figure out what was wrong with him. Until they finally said, no, we're going to go to our traditional healers. And so once he did that, the individual, he did his thing and discovered why he was ill, because he offended the entity. The entities, at least in our region, we would call them Ansisit or Kaiban, depending on, I don't know, where they are. They called him an espiritista, but basically he was like a medicine man or a spiritualist. What he did was they put together a food offering, an atang, and then they did the required ceremonies, and supposedly that's when he got well after that.
Hmm.
So there's a lot of appeasement that takes place, a lot of making sure that everything is in harmony, because unlike the concept of good and evil, like, oh, you're evil, I'm good, whatever, it's more like we all exist in this space, therefore we should learn how to respect each other, learn how to live in harmony. So that's why there was always this, it's a very different way of thinking, it's perspective, that we have to look at how we all exist in the space, therefore we have to learn how to live together.
It's more of an awareness of everybody else as opposed to being just self-aware or just caring about self. It's how you actually interact with everybody else and everything else.
Mm-hmm. And very similar to indigenous cultures throughout the world, right? When we're talking about where we're at right now, Turtle Island or the U.S., Native American communities also look at the harmonious relationship that we have with the land, with all living, non-living things. So that's where the threat animism also creates that intersection and that parallel. Okay.
It's a great reminder. It's definitely a great reminder for us to be in practice of that, because especially in the United States, we get so wrapped up in just, what's it mean to me? What's it all about for me?
I mean, me.
Exactly. 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 Yeah. And there's such value in just being able to take care of, like, you know, at least having consideration what other people are thinking or experiencing, or what other, like, our environment is experiencing just from our ways of bearing.
Mm-hmm. And how your actions contribute to the harmony or also the non-harmonious relationships as well, since we're all interconnected, that idea mm-hmm. of that. Now we have the context. Let's now kind of come into learning more about you, Ka Virgil. In your bio, I'm fascinated about your knowledge and direct connection of coming from a bloodline of healers, both on your maternal and your paternal lineages. So as mentioned earlier, many of us may be disconnected from this knowledge, and it might be due to various factors outside of our own will, and we're seeing a growing resurgence of young people at all different ages yearning for a desire to discover and reconnect. So we're revisiting this question from our first season that we asked you on Clubhouse when we're now able to record for many generations to come and learn from. Thank you for offering this gift of knowledge to our community for generations to come. Please share with us the bloodline of healers that are on both sides of your family. I know there's different types of healers. You're mentioning a medicine man earlier in your previous response, right? There's different types of healers that exist in our archipelago. What type of healing did both sides of your family practice? And provide us with some context of each of these modalities that you're about to mention.
Well, sure. Yes. Okay. So if we look at societies, if we observe a small puruk or a barangay, a small village, usually there would be someone who would have some kind of knowledge of healing. However, because there is one individual who's taking care of the community, usually they would have different practices, different talents up their sleeves. And as the community gets larger and larger into a town, for example, a city, then comes to that are more of different traditional healers, but they begin to specialize in certain practices. And some people, they may be good in, you know, some kind of hands-on work. Others might be good in herbal medicine or more of the spiritual aspects. But they begin to specialize in these different practices. So in the case of my maternal grandmother, Alejandra Melendres Miguel Mayor, from Lawag, her father was from Agunit Binras, which is now Pacifico Marcos. This area is the region where there were a lot of Pitman peoples, because the Ilocos is not just Iloco or Ilocano. We have the Pitman, who are the people who are more associated with the Abra. We also have the Yapayao, those associated with Apeo. And then we have some other peoples who may have migrated in. The different types of healers. Actually, my Nula, she was, first of all, she was a very prominent Mamalto, which is a partera in Spanish, or a traditional midwife, traditional obstetrician. And it was very, it's kind of ironic, because when she was born, she was born breech. And when somebody is born breech, it's understood in society that that individual would become a healer, a midwife, or someone who would be very helpful even in the community. So because she was born breech, that was a belief. However, there were complications in the delivery process that her mother passed away. And the interesting thing is as if her death was symbolic for the birth of somebody who would help to bring life to, I wish I knew a number, you know, hundreds, thousands, I don't know, of other individuals. A lot of my cousins in Hawaii, they would also brought forth that because it was her. So that was one aspect. She was also a mamulo, which comes from the root word mulo, which is a broken bone or a sprain. So it had to do with bone setting, basically. One of my cousin's husband, for example, he came to the house of crutches. She did her magic and he just walked out without using crutches. They are very keen in sensing all these different subtleties of imbalances in the human anatomy and physiology. She was also, because of these type of practices, these two, the interrelation of some type of hands-on work, which in this case would be Ablon. Ablon is known in our region amongst the Iloco, the Itnog, and the Yapayao. In other regions, it would be known as Hilot. So what I did was I started to ask different ethnolinguistic groups, you know, around the Philippines, and ask what they called their term for a form of manual medicine. Okay, I said manual medicine. I did not say massage. I could say massage, which would be a subcategory. But when we say manual medicine, it has a different context. Because whatever practices, even here in the States, if we look at all the different manual modalities, back in the origin where they came from, they were actually used for medical practices for as part of the diagnosis, and then they would apply the manual medicine. Of course, when it comes here to the States, it undergoes a process of becoming categorized, and it turns into a massage. But Ablon manual medicine was another aspect. She did also have practices of the Manglalag or the Banglan, which should be considered the shaman. there were certain practices that were done. And Mungalag is like a deep term. Bablan is more of a general term, but you could hear the cognates Bablan, Balian, Bailan, Babailan. And so that's how that one is defined as. And I just say it is a shaman, because the shamans were not just people who just danced around and went to travel to other worlds. No, they were also the not only the physicians, but also the counselors. They were, in a way, they were also entertainers. They had so many different aspects to them that made them what they were. There was also the aspect of herbalism that was practiced. But her simple things that she would have was just the lana, the coconut oil, and also a concoction, a sapsapo, which would be like a liniment, for example. It basically had alcohol, and she would put simple things like garlic even, into ginger. There was, a brigo from San Nicolas. He did not really use coconut oil. There was only a couple of times I saw him using coconut oil, but he mainly used basi with crushed ginger. So basi is sugarcane wine with crushed ginger. And that's what he would use to manipulate the body. In regards to the connection with the medical model, with Jose Abrego, he was very proud to show me these casts that came from the legs or the arms of patients that the doctors brought over to him. The doctors would cut the casts, and then they would have him work on the person's arm or the leg or whatever extremity it was, and they would leave the casts there. There were several of them too. He showed me, he pointed down like, look, look, look. So I mean to say that even those in the hospitals, they still have, to a degree, a belief in the old medical traditions. Of course, in the big cities, it's kind of the other way around. For example, when there was a conference in, I think in Makati, I was invited to introduce myself. This was for PITAC, Philippine Institute of Traditional Alternative Healthcare. And at that time, the director or the president was Alfonso Lagaya. And he invited me up. I introduced myself. And at the time, I had the manuscript I think it was the first book or the second one, I'm not sure. But I had a manuscript, and I told them what this was. And I started to speak about our traditional healers and such. Out of the crowd, there was this one doctor, nurse, fighting home, what she was, a doctor, herself told. She started bursting out in laughter, literally ridiculing what I was saying. And I was stunned. And I could see Dr. Lagaya, he put his head down. Because for Dr. Lagaya, he was very adamant. Well, first of all, Philippine Institute of Traditional and Alternative Healthcare. This is something that this is an organization that still exists today where they really look towards promoting traditional forms of what is now considered complementary and alternative healthcare or medicine, CAM, CAM. And he just simply said, there's still a lot of people who are they have more of that mentality, they come from an education that looks down on our old practices. But there were also other times where one incident, for example, where there's one person who was severely ill, the group of doctors, they could not come up with a diagnosis. And they were seeking the help of some of the traditional healers to intervene. So the people, they do have the best of two worlds. For example, if I had a sprained ankle, I would go to a traditional healer, get that work on. However, if my appendix is about to burst, I'm not going to go to someone who's going to dance around and, you know, do whatever. I'm going to go straight to the hospital and take care of it. Unless, you know, there's a track record where that individual, you know, this person here and takes care of things. But generally, yeah, it's also important to know, yeah, there is a time and place for everything. And so we have the best of two worlds. Go to the traditional healer, go to the medical facility. If one doesn't work, then you have an option of going to the other one and vice versa.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I mean, it's kind of how, at least for myself, I view medicine here in the United States. There's the alternative medicine, which I tend to lean more towards, but if there's something traumatic, then I would definitely go to traditional Western medicine. One of the things that you mentioned about Ablon, which I think is really great for our audience members to know, because Ablon, also in some regions known as Hilot, the generalization of it is that it is just massage, but it sounds as if it's a more holistic approach where it sounds as if it's energy work and then herbals and then other different practices. And I think that's really a great point for everybody to understand about Ablon or Hilot, because we do have just this one dimensional perspective on it. And to know more about that, really, I actually just found out about a friend of mine. She's also studying to be a Hilot, and she was mentioning that it is just much more than body manipulation. There's a more of a holistic approach to it. And it really just piqued my curiosity in finding out more about what that is. I'm glad we're having this conversation now.
Yes, because I've communicated with a handful of people in the Philippines also, and I made sure that we make a distinction of what this actually is. Is it just a massage, or is it more? Is it more of a form of manual medicine? And a lot of them, they did make the necessary adjustments, so to speak, so that they address it as such, especially here in the West, because things, you know, they just understand. Think, okay, you put your hands on the individual, you rub them, that's a massage. Mm-hmm. However, if you look at chiropractors, physical therapists, osteopaths, they also put their hands on the body, do some type of manipulation. You don't call them massage therapists, right? They have their distinct titles, my distinct characteristics. So why not with our own traditional method of manual medicine? We have our distinct way of doing things. So I'm very particular. I'm very strict on making sure that the students who come here, and even those out there, you know, with their own backgrounds, that they make that distinction. Of course, there has to be that awareness that we are, for example, here in the United States, and we have to also be careful of certain terminology. So for that reason, if I am speaking to a university, I would talk in terms of indigenous form of manual medicine. If I am in front of the medical community, for example, I would say it's indigenous form, but I also would add on other terms like the traditional form of manual therapy. The things that they would help to understand, and they may not think, oh, are you practicing medicine without a license? You know, things like that, you know, just basic things.
Right.
So that was my maternal side. My mother's brother, he was Uncle Cecil, Proceso Mayor. He was considered, especially in where we had some of our relatives in Sinangit, Ilocos Sur, he was known as the local Tupraan or the Katayan, which Tupra is spit, Katayan is saliva. And whenever, because Sinayad is a coastal town, so people, they engage in fishing, and what comes with the territory may be jellyfish. So sometimes they will get stung. People are swimming or going fishing, whatever. Now, of course, the jellyfish, you know, they do inject or whatever, you know, the poisons, and it becomes a stinging sensation, or in some cases, a paralyzing effect. Now, they would call on my uncle, and he would literally take a saliva and start rubbing the areas that were affected. And of course, if we look at that, think about that, like, ooh, that's gross, you know, putting some spit on somebody. However, if we look at the science of what's going on here, the saliva, human saliva, animal saliva, it does have certain enzymes that help to break down other types of compounds or what have you. So in this case, the application of saliva basically means that we're using it because of its property of breaking down the poisons, in this case, the toxins, so that it alleviates. It's similar to when we were on an excursion at a tide pool. Somebody stepped on the sea urchin. So our zoology teacher, this was, I think we went to Quezon province with us. And the zoology teacher told us, guys, okay, you're going to have to pee on the person's foot. And so here were three of us guys, you know, we were trying to create a stream of urine, but unfortunately we had empty bladders, so we couldn't pee on the guy's foot. But it goes to show that even urine has medicinal qualities. I mean, and you can hear different cultures where they would even consume their urine. Well, one Tibetan doctor, Lobsang Dondop, he told me specifically that the urine of a male child up to the age of 7 has a potency, you know, to cure. Mm-hmm. It's very specific on the age and the gender type, because of hormones, you know, chemicals and such that would come from the male child. So that was my uncle. On my father's side, Vidal Santos Apostol from Camiling, Tarlac, his father, Maximo Apostol. His mother was Rosa Guzman Santos. She was from Alcala, Pangasinan. Now, she passed on the hands-on work. Now, the Ablon or the Ilot. Ilot is another term also that's used, you know, without the H, same thing. And my father, he also passed on alchemy. So basically, what happened was that I had both my maternal and paternal side of the healers. People would come to the house to see my bula. And I was always by her side holding the two bottles. One was the oil, the other one was the liniment. And everything that was being performed, it was sinking deep into my subconscious mind. And only later in my life would these things started to come out. And all of a sudden, there was an incident where somebody came to me and I helped that person. My father, on the other hand, he was very keen on introducing to me the indigenous terminology and the science behind was terminology. So for the longest time, I've been using the coined or the two words indigenous science to describe what we're doing. And that's something that I emphasize here at the school so that the people really understand things from that perspective and not just say, oh, yeah, you just do like this and you do like that. And then, you know, oh, poof, and then, you know, the pain is gone and person as well. I made it a point to really delve deep into really researching it from the traditional lens, cultural lens, from the medical Western lens, from a scientific lens, all these different aspects, because all of these can describe or define, you know, what is going on, you know, through these different sciences. But for the person who's actually practicing this information or these different forms of healing, they already have this because it's just part of the holistic way of thinking, of being, you know, within our old societies. Unfortunately, because of modernization, we're becoming more westernized, and things are starting to become more compartmentalized. That's why if we go to various hospitals, you know, the medical doctors, oh, you have this like that. Okay, you're going to have to go to this specialist. You have to go to that specialist. So everything is compartmentalized, whereas the traditional healers, then it's possible that they have all these different aspects that they can help the individual. And if necessary, they may also refer to another type of healer.
Thank you so much for painting the picture of your healing lineage on both sides of the family, Ka Virgil. Now,
one thing I also wanted to mention is that my daughter, she did learn from her father. All of these different practices, even midwifery, she learned from his father. And they used to travel offering the medium service. It's almost similar to, like in China, they would say the barefoot doctors, where they would travel to different provinces. Same with them, they would travel and offer their healing services, especially when they started, a lot of the clan, they migrated to Isabela, first in Vera, which is Arrojas now, Isabela, and then into Naguilian. And they would offer their services there, but they would also go back and forth to Ilocos Norte and do the healing work as well.
So from hearing you share both sides of your family's healing modalities, it wasn't specific by sex, right? So it wasn't like females would specialize in one thing and male identified would specialize in something else. They would kind of be intertwined in different modalities.
Oh, yes, because if we look at the term midwife, that was one thing I was wondering, wait a minute, the person is a male, but a midwife, would they be called a mid-husband? I did read something. I forgot. I guess we could just look it up. But midwife is the actual proper term, even if the practitioner is male.
Okay.
So, my great-grandfather, he was a midwife. Jose Ocampo, who was also my Eskrima teacher, he was a midwife. So, it could be both.
Paint us more a picture of the world, of the different healing modalities that you have mentioned, especially your grandmother. She had, you said, midwife. She did hands-on manual medicine. She did, you mentioned, a little bit of herbalism, shamanism. Now, you did mention the use of coconut oil. You've mentioned ginger. You've mentioned garlic. I'm curious to know, as we are discovering more of our medicinal herbs, and throughout the diaspora, were there other herbs, to your knowledge, that were used within the traditional practices? Let's start for that, and then I have a follow-up to that one.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so the popular one is ginger.
Yeah.
Because if we look at it, that is a anti-inflammatory. It helps with the blood circulation. There's all these different properties. Sometimes what happens is that the healers, they are in touch with the plant spirit or the spirits of the plants, where they commune and they receive knowledge of what the properties are, so that they can use them for various ailments. Or another popular one, which would also be used, is guava, especially if we're looking at home remedies, so to speak. Guava, that's another one.
Are you talking about the fruit, the leaf?
In this case, mainly the leaves.
Okay. Yes.
But even the twigs, you can use them as toothpicks. It does have an astringent quality. So naturally, if you start cleaning your teeth, even the other places, they use some kind of medicinal twig or something, to clean your tooth. But because it also has a coagulant properties. So if there was a cut or wounds, it would also help to, the astringent qualities helps to cleanse, but the coagulant properties, it helps to also heal and stop bleeding and such. I do remember we were just out and about one time, and one of our friends was scratching his chest, and all of a sudden he scratched off a live mole. you know, the moles that protrude out as opposed to
yeah.
flat.
Yeah.
And he literally scratched it off. So he was bleeding. It was just like a blood just pouring from one little tiny spot. And it so happened that there was a guava tree right there. So he kept on chewing and masticating mm-hmm. the leaves. Of course, it mixes with the saliva and then placing it as a poultice.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a couple of times until finally it stopped bleeding.
Yeah.
So there are...
people do that too in Peru. So, yeah. Okay, so you said mentioned guava.
First of all, when it comes to plant medicine, I would refer to Sister Lynn Pastricar on that.
Yeah, for sure. And also, I imagine involved in the different various modalities, there's also incantations or prayers, and there's also anting-anting, right? And we're not asking you to, like, because I know sometimes that comes with with sacred protection, depending on different incantations. But is that also part of, like, what's being brought into the different modalities that you've mentioned? Just to get a bigger picture of what we're looking at when it comes to traditional healing modalities.
For those who are more in the remote places, there would be more of an adherence to these old traditions. But even in the cities, there's still those who practice wearing, like, medallions, for example, you know, the anting-anting type that have the old Catholic symbolism, or it goes even beyond Catholic symbolism, because there's a lot of... there's even Kabbalah in there and everything, different things that are mixed. Stones, like, for example, my desk here, I have this tektite. So this is a rather large one right here. So this is a combination of earth and space and matter.
Describe that maybe for folks that can't see. Yeah. Sort of maybe describe what that looks like to our...
Oh, okay. So... this particular one, there's like an avocado, the shape of it.
Yeah.
And it does have some kind of gleam to it. But basically what happens...
like it's black, right? It looks black?
It's black,
color?
Yes.
It's black.
It is. It's black, yes. That's the usual color for tektites. Okay. So basically what happens is that there's a meteorite that would strike the earth. And because of the strong impact, it would throw... a lot of the earth material, as well as, you know, the whatever broke off from the meteorite, you know, back into space. But because the meteorite was basically hot, you know, all of this stones and everything, they become molten, and now they're floating in space. And because of no gravity, they naturally form into a spherical form, floating in space. So there, these stones are still in liquid form, round, and eventually what happens is that they cool down, and they, a lot of times, they maintain that spherical form. Other times they can start to travel back to, you know, through the atmosphere and to, you know, back to Earth, and sometimes it starts to form different ways depending on, it's almost like a drop of water, you know, that's why you have that drip kind of formation. That's basically what this is. You have others that are like barbell shape, because they're in liquid form, but then they start to, like, do this number where they separate, and all of a sudden it cools down, but they're still connected, so it looks like a barbell. But oftentimes they're also just round because of what happened in space. These tektites were found in grave sites. So it means to say that they were believed to be forms of amulets. And I had, in my book, Way of the Ancient Healer, I have a picture where, or even the description, I talk about tektites. I mentioned how there was this one medium. I asked him, you know, how can I use these tektites, you know, for healing? And this was a 13-year-old boy. He was in spiritual trance. And what came out was that I was to take some of the tektites and put it at the base of the spine, and also the crown. A 14-year-old kid. But this was something that was channeled to him. Once he snaps out of it, he's just like any other kid, you know, just goofing off or what have you. But I started to look into these books on properties, metaphysical properties of stones and minerals, gems. And sure enough, it talked about putting the tektites at the root chakra and also the crown chakra to help in balancing the entire, you know, the chakras along the spine. There is the Mannoma, which is the snake or animal bite cure. Uncle Cecil, he was bit by a rabid dog. There was three of them. And he and his companions, they were brought to different healers. Of course, he had tunnels of essence. And the particular one that he went to took out four different stones. Oh, by the way, the dog also bit a bit of pig, and the pig died. So anyway, the healer took out four different stones. One was a red, I forgot the other color of the other one, black and white. He would take the stones and place it in Basi, the sugarcane wine, for cleansing. Place it on the area that he was bit. And he said that the two stones, except for the black and white, would stay. He tried to put the other stones on, but they would just drop off. And so he asked, based on the black and white stone, was the dog gray? And sure enough, the dog was gray. And all of a sudden, he said that he saw the stones started to travel. So for example, if I was bit right here, the stones would start to travel in such a manner as if it was following the venous flow, while where the poisons were being, transported. And they would all of a sudden stop. The healer would then take these stones, put it back in the Basi, and then he said that there was some kind of sludge or something that was coming out from these stones. And then he would put them back, and then they would continue along its path until finally the stones would stop or they would just fall off. And then that's when it was indicated that the poisons were absorbed. But even considering the Mannoma, these type of, they're called as, they could be called like snake charmers. But basically, sometimes what they do is they communicate with snakes. And it is a belief that some of these snakes, they have certain type of stones on their head. These are just things that I heard and also heard from others, where they would take the stones, where it was somehow gifted to the healers because of their communication with each other. And the stones would be used for such purposes. I was even told the exact same thing in India, where they have these snakes and they have the stones where the healers would use them. So there are practices that involve some type of amulets and such. And of course, when it comes to the prayers, A lot of the so-called Latin type of prayers were adopted, oración. But then there's also the native prayers that are spoken in the native tongue. When it comes to the prayers, however, more of those that are indigenous, sometimes the healers would seemingly speak in tongues. And the reason why I say that is because, for example, Casiso, he did witness a Hmong Alang, a shaman, who came from the Lopes region, but when she started to do a chanting, it was a different language altogether. And this is something that a lot of the shamans in the Philippines, they would engage in speaking in what sounds like a different language. Now, there may be the power of something that sounds very mystical. Even my friend Manuel Uspicio Dulnoan, Ifugao, he had mentioned to me that when he used to listen to the Mumbakis, they would be speaking, regular Ifugao, but then once they go into their chants, all of a sudden, they would be speaking in a totally different language that he would not understand. But the old folks, the elders, they understood everything, and they explained that this was an archaic form of the Ifoga language. And they had to translate to him, you know, what was being said and such. The prayers, yeah, that's a whole different topic that can take up.
Yeah. I mean, it's also in song. You mentioned chanting, right? It's also in song. It's also in music. It's also in dance. Right. I imagine that's also intertwined.
Yeah. And there is something that we call dalot, which is a rhythmic form. It has a certain cadence and measure and rhythm to them. Mm-hmm. So there was one elder, he said, oh, this is our traditional rapping. The reason why he said that is because what comes out of them is not necessarily something that is memorized. It's something that free flows. Mm-hmm. That's why he said it was, you know, our traditional form of rapping.
Yeah. Mm. It's kind of only seems like a historical offshoot at the Balakdasan too.
Mm, right. Yes. Yes, yes. And our old folk tales, they were often performed. Now, for example, there's one Biak Ni Lam Ang, The Life of Lam Ang. That's how it was also chanted, sang.
Yeah.
Now, that it was through that rhythm and cadence and measure.
How about the egg, Virgil? I've also heard people bring in eggs. So are you familiar? How is that used in our traditional practice?
Oh yeah. The egg. It's different. Some call it different terms. One term that I was told was sampingwar, which is actually a Spanish term, but it was adopted. Now there was one elder woman actually here in LA County. She was in West Covina.
Okay.
Like somewhere across the street over here.
Yeah.
Or Covina. But anyway, her method was to, okay, so let's say I have this tektite here. It looks like avocado, but also looks like an egg, right? Right.
Yeah.
There is the old practice of balancing the egg. So what they're doing is they're communicating with the spirits. And if they are able to balance the egg, that means that their question was the positive one, for example. Like they ask a question, the egg keeps on falling, but once the egg stands up on end, then the one that they asked, that was the one that the procedure that they needed to do, for example.
Mm.
Or something else, like a particular name that needs to be given.
Mm.
That woman, she actually was starting to train me to do that.
Mm-hmm.
She said that spirit told her that she had trained me. So the rest of the afternoon, you know, I was practicing trying to balance the game. That's crazy. Usually what they would do is they would take a plate. It's usually porcelain. And, you know, on the bottom part, you have like that ridge on the bottom. Here's the thing, and then there's a smaller part.
Yeah.
They would just place it like on the end of that to kind of aid in standing. They tried it. I thought, oh, no wonder. You know, they're like cheating. Uh-uh. You try to take a plate, put the egg there, and try to balance it. It's near impossible. But here she was, doing the process of doing divination. She would balance it. She would balance it, and it wasn't just like one time. It would balance, and so it reminds me of a Kalinga who also said that one of the healers, one of the Kalinga women, did the same thing. But he swore that there was no plate or anything. It was just balance, you know, straight on the flat surface, just like that.
Mm.
And so there's a lot of things that is very miraculous, so to speak. The woman, she would then take the egg and crack it and then into a glass of water. And then she would do further divination by reading the albumin or maybe the quality of the yolk. Yeah, there's different things to look at. It's similar to when they would sacrifice an animal and then they would perform divination by reading the liver. So these are really archaic practices.
Do you remember what region of the Philippines she was from?
Which one?
The woman that you were just talking about.
Oh, the egg?
Yeah. I was just wondering if that was like a regional practice of hers.
Oh, no, it's not a regional practice.
No.
I mean, it's done in different parts of the Philippines. She's from the Ilocos region.
Okay. Can you explain to our community what divination is?
A divination involves, it's almost like a mixture of different things. Of course, you're tapping into the spiritual aspects where you may be communicating with the spirits of the land or entities or what have you. But then there's also the innate abilities of the individual to sense certain things if we just say sense certain things, that could come on like a vibrational level, but it also could be on a psychic level. Mm. And there are those who also have the gift of foresight and seeing into the future. I've heard so many things where they said they went to one person and years later, that thing happens, but it was very, very to the point, on the dot. So it's like, how could it be? Divination does involve various methods to tap into this place where we could obtain information. Whether it's on knowing the type of illness, what needs to be done, or it could be even things like trying to locate something that was lost or trying to heal somebody. There's different reasons for that, for divination.
This is just, it's so great because you hear about these different types of modalities in other parts of the world and you see the similarities. And I haven't, and just in my own knowledge or lack there of knowledge, of really understanding how much of those same traditions and same practices are actually reflected in our own culture. I don't really hear a lot of that. And it's, again, it's just really great to hear that, because I feel like there's a definite, there's a link, a commonality with everybody, and it's just their own interpretations. But I have yet to hear the interpretations or the practices at a deeper level with the Filipino culture, and there's so many traditions that overlap. It's really awesome to hear more in depth of what that is.
Oh, yes. It's very, very embedded in our psyche, in our DNA.
Yeah.
Very much embedded. For example, when Spanish came to the Philippines, they introduced the Santo Niño or whatever, and they gave it to the people. And then they would leave. And then when they came back, they noticed that the Santo Niño was alongside their other anitos, their statues and such. So what they were doing is, well, what it shows is that these people were very spiritual. Not necessarily religious, but spiritual. In that they saw, like, oh, there's another anito that we could add to our pantheon of deities to provide more power, whatever it was. And of course, because of religions, they say, oh no, those are of the devil. Then they say, this is the one true religion, the one true God. And so basically what they're doing is they're telling them to shun all of their old practices, their religious practices, their ceremonies, rituals, and such. But what happens is that these people, they still have that spirituality in them. So the spirituality was merely transferred from the belief of an anito within a stone into a Christian angel, or you know, or whatever, Santo Nino or something like that. The psychological belief that's deeply embedded is still there. The belief or the spirituality of the people is still there. Of course, there's also a lot of practices that were converted, so to speak. That's why if we look at other practices from other places in the world, they have their practices that are supposedly Christian or Catholic, but if you really look at them, they really derive from their original practices. Same thing in the Philippines.
Yeah. I was actually just having a conversation with another person about how like the religion of Christianity or Catholicism, how it just dominated whatever region it was being introduced to, and then just shut down some of those practices. But yet you still see a little bit of the local traditions of their medicines or their healing practices, and it made me just think about how much we've lost in that connection we talk about. Because again, that religion, it's not saying that it's good or bad, but it more reflected the me, as opposed to just being in context or connection with everything else, and how much that has been lost through the practice of Catholicism or Christianity, because it was such a dominating force, especially during the Spanish Inquisition, right? Like that was their main mission. You know, you are an author of two books. You co-authored Healing Hand of Hilot and Way of the Ancient Healer, Sacred Teachings of the Filipino Ancestral Traditions. And you spoke a lot about your lineage and the region of where you're from, right? And your family is from. Can you speak, and you also touched a little bit on the different modalities throughout the Philippines. Are there any other modalities that you would add to that as practices that you could share and with our community?
Well, I love it.
Outside of your lineage?
Outside the lineage?
Meaning?
A little bit. So they get to varying degrees. Because sometimes, for example, even the Ablong, the Hilot, because I did my research. I traveled. I wanted to see. First of all, I learned from my mother's and father's side. But then I also wanted to make comparison to see the knowledge of other people, in order to understand deeper of what I was already doing myself. I wanted to make not only the comparisons, but also the similarities. I wanted to see the context of how they evolved, where they came from. And so there are practices, for example, in the northern part of the Philippines that are not found in the southern part, or maybe not popular at least, and also practices in the central southern part that is not very common in the north. For example, I know that there's one, a Naulaning, which is to rescue. It's a practice where it's also another shamanic practice where they would have water in a porcelain bowl, and they would take grains of rice, they would toss it into the water. And it's believed that the water or the rice, the grains of rice that were afloat, that's where the lost spirit is, because you know they called the spirit to return back to the person. So in other words, the person experienced some type of fright, which cause a part of their soul essence to leave their body. So in other words, that's like a soul loss, as they would call it in shamanism. So when they would collect the rice that was floating, they would attach it to the shirt. For example, they put it, oftentimes they would take it to them. Like for example, here's a shirt and here's all the rice. They would kind of like wrap it in the garment, the clothing, and then they would tie a string so that the grains of rice was, attached and tied in the garment. And so that was a way of allowing the spirit to gradually make its way back into the individual. So that was one of the practices that my opong used to do. Now, in the Visayan region, there is something that's called bulo-bulo, where they would take a glass of water, and sometimes they would place a certain stone. It might be, something when digging or such. But they also have a straw or a reed, and they would start blowing, making bubbles. But what they would do is to encircle the individual who will need the healing work. So as they're blowing the bubbles, what they're doing is they're gathering all the negativity, the disease aspect that's still in the etheric field, because it's believed that the disease can be initially found in the etheric field before it eventually manifests into the physical body. So what they're doing is they're attacking it, or they're healing the person on an etheric level by doing the bulo-bulo, blowing bubbles. And what is expected to happen is that the water will start to become murky. And that's an indicator that a lot of the gunk in the etheric field was collected and trapped into the water itself. Some people would say, oh, that's just from the person's spit, or they have something in their mouth. No, that's not the case. One of my teacher, he also had the ability to do the bolo-bolo, because my eskrima is mainly Northern Luzon, but I also have one by the same lineage. He did the bolo-bolo, but he would do it with seawater, and then that supposedly that would enable him to drink the water itself.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a couple of practices.
So, it just came up for me, because you hear some of the, especially the spit component. Like, I hear that in other indigenous practices. What came up for me is, I wonder if there's ever been a convention of where you have shamans from that are Aboriginal, shamans from the indigenous natives of the Americas, the Mayans, and then where they're all just converged together and just smoking a peace pipe and hey, so what is your practice? It's like, oh yeah, we do the same thing, but we call it this, or we do it this way. It'd be really interesting to see even more so that the commonality and the overlap and just how they practice it all differently. It's very interesting.
Yeah, and it is that animistic base or foundation that's
right.
That commonality.
Yeah.
Sometimes when that happens, it could be very powerful,
mm-hmm.
but yet at the same time, it could also be met with resistance, usually by the people themselves, because they do not want their sacred information to just go out and be abused, so to speak, by, for example, pharmaceutical companies and such.
Mm-hmm.
If that has happened, that does happen. It does happen. There was one case of a friend in Mexico City. She gathered, she was documenting healing knowledge, plant knowledge, all of these different practices from different groups in Mexico. So all of these were found in her home. And one day, her house went poof, up in flames.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, we're seeing it with even Moringa or Malungai, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's now on vitamin shelves. So the commercialization of plant medicine is real. And exploitation of all of this. I mean, it's even going into kava now too, right? So I think we're at the first half of this discussion now with Ka Virgil about his personal journey and research into our Philippine ancestral traditions within the realm of health and wellness. Thank you for joining us for our 7th episode of season 4. We're talking with author and co-founder of Kailukuan School of Indigenous Science, Ka Virgil Mayor Apostol. Feel free to take a quick stretch, refill your water or tea. We'll be right back for our second half after this quick break.